this week's programme a report on the teaching of history in the English schools. We ask what lessons we in Ireland can draw from it. The Right Kind of History, Teaching the Past in 20th Century England by David Cannadine, Jenny Keating and Nicola Sheldon is the result of a 2.5-year research project. When it comes to recommendations, the report is quite tentative, telling us that it's not sure the answer is to redesign the history curriculum yet again. Let's hear what our contributors have to say about the report. Dermot Ferriter is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. Deirdre MacMahona has been a teacher of history at junior and leaving cert levels in Muckross Park College in Dublin for the past 25 years. She's an active member of the History Teachers Association of Ireland. Kieran Brady is a professor in the history department at TCD. His main interests are in Irish and English history of the 16th and early 17th centuries and in the writing of history itself. Dermot, what did you make of this book?
It's interesting that you used the word tentative because that is a word or a description that seems very apt. There's an awful lot of qualifications in this book. The dangers of making generalisations about the way history was taught and about what you can actually do with the subject. So it is quite tentative. It's not a rollicking read. This is as much an administrative history of education and where history fits into the education system. But it does highlight an awful lot of areas that are very pertinent and relevant to the teaching of history in Ireland today and the status of history in Ireland today. There are some very worrying suggestions about the place of history in the syllabus at the moment, particularly with this proposed new junior cert syllabus, that you reduce the number of core subjects. And there's a suggestion that history will remain a core part of the curriculum, but that's not the same as saying it's going to remain a core subject.
Just clarify one thing for me, Dermot. Is it compulsory at the moment at leaving cert level?
No, it's compulsory up to junior cert level. So you're talking about up to the age of about 15, and then it's an optional subject. It was interesting to look at what happened to leaving cert history in the 1990s in particular, because there was a fairly dramatic decline in the numbers taking leaving cert history in the 1990s, the mid-1990s, towards the end of the 90s, from over 25% to below 20%. And then it stabilised again in the first decade of this century at about 22-23%. But it's not compulsory after junior cert.
After junior. Deirdre, what did you pick up from this in the main in terms of what might be of interest and use to us here?
Well, first of all, just a quick response. I'd echo what Dermot said about this particular book. It's very, very detailed, but refreshingly jargon-free, I found, so that the long journey through 20th century education in Britain, you know, was a difficult read. But at times, I found actually the profiles of the various ministers interesting, and at times even offering, dare I say, a little bit of comic relief. There was one particular minister in the 1930s called Edward Wood, who was Lord Irwin, who's described in the book as a high church fox-hunting Tory who had read history at Oxford but displayed no interest whatsoever in education, never mind in history. And he comes out, there's a great quote in the book where he's described as somebody who looks on the purpose of education, where we want schools that will train them up for servants and butlers. And that contrasts then with, say, Ellen Wilkinson in the 1940s, who I think was sometimes referred to as Red Ellen, somebody who campaigned very much for social justice, etc. But she's interesting not only because she was the first woman minister, but more, I think, importantly, she was the first teacher who held that position and presided over the training of teachers and introduced institutes of education in universities. So I found that particular aspect interesting, and the impact of, or not as the case may be, of the various ministers.
Yeah. Kieran Brady, one thing that struck me was that it's regarded as a hard subject in England, as, you know, for people with above average intelligence. Is that true here? But it's seen that way.
Well, there's a perception.
Yeah,
particularly at the higher level in the Leaving Cert. But at ordinary level, and particularly with the curriculum changes that took place in the early part of this century, I think history has become far more accessible and a far more, as it were, interactive subject than it used to be. And I notice that one of the few non-tentative recommendations that they make in this book is that history, which is not mandatory up to the age of 15 in the United Kingdom, should be made so. And that's something I think we should all bear in mind.
Yeah.
But can I say something about the book itself? I agree with the other panellists. This is not a page-turner. This is not a book that will keep you awake wanting to find out what happens next. But it is an extraordinarily ambitious undertaking, because what they're trying to do is to follow the process by which a discipline, a mode of understanding the world, is actually put through into the school's curriculum, both at primary and secondary level. Mm. Now, they say, in, and that's characteristic of the style, that they're the first ones to do this, and I think they are. And they've taken on a hugely complex problem here. Because it's very hard to isolate the kind of forces that apply to this process of introducing thinking in primary and secondary levels. And in some ways, I think it might have been better for them had they isolated those forces and talked about a larger cultural and ideological environment, talked about the policy and the managerial side of things, talked more in a thematic way about developments in the history of educational thought.
Yeah, in fact, they do make quite a bit of the idea throughout the book that you can't ignore what's been happening in educational theory, sort of whether progressive education or whatever is dominant at a particular time.
They're trying to strike a balance between giving an overview of how the education system was perceived and conceived and then how history fitted into that. And it's a difficult balancing act. And in fairness to them, you know, they do underline the extent to which ideological considerations and bias and preferences of various people who were instrumental in this area affected the status of history and indeed the status of education generally. Deirdre mentioned this earlier on about people in senior positions with regard to influencing education policy who didn't have an interest in education. Ironically, Winston Churchill, for example, when you consider the way in which he invoked Britain and its past and its potential glories, an inspiration from previous battles, he didn't really seem to have any practical interest in education. And then when you go on to the 60s and the 70s, at a time when Britain is really struggling with its sense of itself and the idea that it's a society that is in decline, how does that affect history? What's the purpose of history? Is history, as perceived by someone like Margaret Thatcher, for example, about teaching patriotic enthusiasm?
It wasn't until the 1980s that, in fact, government at either local or central level took an interest in what was being taught. What was the score here? I mean, for example, give me some idea of what it was like after the foundation of the state. What interest did the government take in what was taught at history level?
Well, the role of the Board of Education, as it saw its own role, was to issue fairly general guidelines, but it wasn't up to them to follow through on implementation. That was to be done at local level. And they're quite hands-off in that sense. And they will make broad recommendations. I mean, there were pamphlets appearing in the early 20th century about what should be the essence of a good historical education. But there isn't a follow-through in terms of ensuring that it's actually implemented.
Yeah, but there was no sense, was there, in terms of the curriculum, that this is an area, meaning very recent history, that you can't talk about. There wasn't a sense of that, was there?
Oh, well, you see, in the schools. Yeah, I mean, there was always disagreement about what you could realistically include in a curriculum. And then you have the extent to which the curriculum will be influenced by contemporary politics. You know, what should we be prioritising? Take the early 1970s, for example. We should be educating for a future in Europe. There's a very obvious focus on a new era there.
Do you get a sense of that, of an interest in Europe? I mean, to what extent is that reflected, Deirdre, in what's taught at in history classes, or joining the EU and so on?
Well, again, I would echo what Dermot was saying, that, I mean, it's sort of the early part of the century, and this was true in Ireland as well, that the main narrative of history is telling Ireland's story. Okay, and our First Minister for Education, Owen McNeill, who of course was a great Gaelic scholar, that really the vision of how the new Cumann na Gael government saw education was a vision of a Gaelic Ireland. So the energy involved in pushing through policy was dictated by this notion of Gaelicisation. And the textbooks even reflect that as well. I mean, I think in most households, in certainly the early part of the century, every shelf would have had Hayden and Lunan.
I was going to ask you, that's still around.
Yes, the short history of the Irish people first came out in 1921. And that's reinforcing, again, this great vision of the Gaelic past, Ireland being the land of saints and scholars, etc. And if I may finish, just to bring it up to when you mentioned about Europe, that this notion that Ireland, you know, going back to our glorious past, were the people who brought civilization to Europe. And that message is reinforced, you know,
you can
later
see,
on as well.
Ciarán, that in any post-revolutionary situation, the role of the historian of education in general will be to endorse the regime, endorse the system.
Yeah, and I think that was certainly the case. And that, in some senses, I mean, to run a parallel between what's the situation in the UK and how it developed in the independent Ireland, there was a lot of soft influence, it seems to me, on the shaping of regional syllabi. in the UK that comes through from the universities, through the Historical Association, and indeed from the public schools. And I think one of my regrets about this current book is that they confine themselves to looking at elementary schools and secondary moderns and comprehensive schools and not the public schools, because they are immensely influential in shaping attitudes both on the way up to the people who become ministers and so on, and in shaping attitudes on the way down. Now, I think the contrast here is that in the independent Irish state, the initial drive is from the bottom up. I mean, I don't think that it was necessary for ministers of education to say, this is how you're going to do it. I think they were already preaching to the converted when they did it. And I think there was a very broad consensus that this was the time to establish, as it were, the cultural liberation and independence of Ireland.
When did that change? I mean, at what point did, if you like, the much maligned Christian Brothers version of history go by the board?
Well, there's something of a crisis in the 1960s worldwide with regard to the teaching of history. And again, it's a reflection of all sorts of contemporary upheavals. What is the purpose of history? Is the focus supposed to be on the heroic narrative? Or should we be looking at changing conceptions of identity, and how can we build that into the curriculum? How do we begin to appreciate the hidden histories, or, you know, bringing out the minority histories? Do we move to an idea of empathy as opposed to this focus on dates and reigns and heroic individuals? So, I mean, the curriculum is affected by that in Ireland in the late 60s and the early 1970s, and there is a shift, you know, away from the traditional narrative.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, and we can see this in this book, that that does create a certain tension or a certain backlash, because people feel some people felt that that went too far, that what was lost then was this sense of a sweeping narrative that will get people to appreciate.
I'm just thinking, though, if you look at the trajectory of a country after a revolution, presumably at a certain point, it will be confident enough to take self-criticism, you know, aboard, to go to the kind of warts and all. I mean, they talk about that here. When did that occur here?
That's actually very early on. And here's a quote from a Board of Education publication. And we're talking here now, the first decade of the
20th century. You're talking about the UK now.
This is in the UK.
But, yeah, right.
There is no surer source of courage than the study of past achievements. And there is no better school of wisdom than the recognition of past mistakes. So there you have those two contrasting.
My question is, when did that?
Can I quote from the 1934 advice, Department of Education advice to teachers, which runs in a very opposite direction and goes like this: in an Irish school in which history is properly taught, the pupils will learn that they are citizens of no mean country, that they belong to a race that has a noble tradition of heroism and persistent loyalty to ideals. In such a school, no formal exhortation should be necessary to bring home to every pupil worth the good faith, courage and endurance of this country, that there are grounds for a belief that a race that has survived a millennium of grievous struggle and persecution must possess qualities that are a guarantee of a great future. Yeah. Irish history has been much distorted by those who wrote from the enemy's standpoint, writers who attempted to justify conquest and expropriation.
Well,
we're sitting on the fence.
What do you find to do among your students? I mean, how interested are they in history? I mean, is it something they gravitate towards or not?
Hugely. I would actually say with confidence that, you know, there's no better time to be a history teacher now, or to be a student sitting in the classroom. It is both a wonderful time, but it's also a worrying time. And I'll come back to that, and Dermot referred to the framework document, and I would like to make a few comments about that in a moment. We've never been in a position before where there's such a rich reservoir of resources. And these resources are feeding into the whole learning and teaching experience. I'll give you one tangible example. If you take something like the census, the digitalisation of the 1901-1911 census, and we owe Katrina Crowe and her colleagues in the National Archives a huge debt, because now at the touch of a button, we can, in the classroom, personalise history, if you like, by using this technology, by looking at, as I say, looking at evidence, teaching skills through actually dealing with the evidence. And this, therefore, makes it a very exciting time to be in the classroom.
I agree with that, but I would add a reservation. And there's now access to so much information and so many different websites and so many different tools that there is the danger that history students will forget to read books. And this is crucial, because you're talking about a generation, and I'm not being dismissive of them in any way. Mm. This is what they are growing up with. It's the environment they're growing up in. But there is a tendency for them to move so quickly from site to site or source of information to a new source of information there can be too much cutting and pasting, and there can be a much shorter attention span. And the joys of going in, as I found as a history student when I started in university, of browsing the shelves and picking out books and reading books, you still need that again to grasp the essence of the subject, I think.
No, I accept that 100%, but you have to bear in mind as well as that most students have been taught very well as well.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt about that.
So they would have gone through all the kind of various skills, through
Kieran,
to the Deirdre's point about the practitioners, the people who are actually doing it. I think one of the healthiest things that prevail with us at the moment is that curricular reform is done not by on high, not by people selected by government, but through the NCCA. Mm-hmm. And the teachers who are at work in the classroom have a hugely important role to play on those committees. In contrast to what I think is truly frightening, and I think Dermot would be frightened by this as well, of choosing one great historian, usually a man, Niall Ferguson, Simon Sharma, to actually give government advice on a curriculum. I mean, I find that a truly frightening prospect, that no matter who it is.
I have a recollection that Sharma was one of those who came down on the side of narrative of a kind of not the danger of losing sight of a broad narrative. Is that right?
This is one of the things that comes out of this book, actually, how reliant they have been on a very narrow set of individuals or even perspectives. That comes through very, very strikingly, I think. And it's the same with regard to perhaps an individual politician who might have a role in this, that, there's far too much weight attached to that. But there is that debate about how you strike the balance. Do you have a curriculum that's overloaded and people are just getting bits and pieces as opposed to getting a strong sense of an overall story and overall development?
It seems to me that the EU story was never really integrated. When we talk about people, there is now, oddly enough, a high consciousness of Europe mainly because of the crisis. But prior to that, there really wasn't. And you could argue that it hadn't been part of the school curriculum. I talk here perhaps out of turn, but my impression was that it wasn't.
Well, in a way it was.
Was it? Yes.
In a way it was, if only in a negative way, because we don't want to do British history anymore. and so what we do instead is European history. Yes. So in the early syllabi, you'll find quite an amount of space being devoted to European history, and hardly any to British history.
On that very point, he says here that there's not much enthusiasm for teaching the history of four nations in England, England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. How about here? There isn't... Would there be much enthusiasm for you saying, would people be happy to take four nations aboard?
Well, Deirdre, who is the practitioner in the classroom, would know better than I about
what's your
that.
Sense of it?
But just seeing on the uptake of the topics, I mean, it is astonishing. 99.5% of those electing to do honours history do it in the modern period. It's a tiny number do the early modern, and there is no provision for medieval. Yeah. That's to be regretted. Of those who take modern history, they all, and I'm sure Deirdre will confirm me on this, they all plumb for one or two topics.
And this is the same in the UK, isn't it? I mean, that story of the Nazi period being one in particular.
Hugely
popular.
With us, it's the period of revolution and independence, not the period afterwards, which I find really interesting. It's dictatorships and democracies. Yeah. And trailing along after that is the history of the USA. Yeah. But even more modern topics just don't seem to get the space. Would that be right?
The topic of your own area, one of your areas, especially the writing of history itself, is that too recherché for secondary level or not?
Well, I think if it's to be done, it has to be done within the topics. I think extracting out thinking history, concepts of history out of that is probably, and I think this is true at third level as well, is probably not the right way to do it. Sure. I think what we ought to do is introduce conceptual problems within discussions of specific topics.
Do you remember your thoughts on that, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question of practicality as well, about what is feasible to teach people at a particular age. And, the whole idea of conceptual analysis and, learning to deal with that kind of a framework as opposed to, the very obvious emphasis on facts. One of the things that comes through this book very strongly are the amount of people who don't remember any of the history at all or the tedious nature of dictation. But another thing that comes through is how important individual inspirational teachers were in instilling a lifelong passion for history that begins at a very early age. And even if that's what they call the chalk and talk approach, as it was in the past,
it
if
made
you
a
had
difference, yeah.
an inspiring teacher, you would retain that interest.
Nonetheless, what I picked up here was that history in the UK is a subject that's badly taught and hated. Now, I don't know how, if that's true for the entire period here, but... That wouldn't be true here.
Very, very emotive terms, and I wonder, you know, what they're based on. But I would disagree. I mean, my experience here, first of all, you can just back it up with statistics, is that, say, looking at Leaving Cert, since the new Leaving Cert syllabus was introduced in 2006, the uptake is almost 25%. You know, so, I mean, you know, those figures, I think, speak for themselves. So, I mean, I repeat, there's no better time to be doing history, and that is revealed in the energy in the classroom.
My sense is that generally in the culture, Ciarán, and this will be true of a lot of countries in the West, the data has replaced history. People talk much more now about data, therefore they're talking about what's coming out of the social sciences, than they are in talking about a sense of a line into the past.
Yeah, I think, and that, by the way, is true not only at second and third
levels, but at fourth level as well, where people are producing databases and so on.
But I think it's important we keep a cool head about this, mm-hmm. that the collection of data is a means to an end rather than an end in itself. And I think the very fact that information, as Deirdre has pointed out, is now so easily available, mm-hmm. is not on Wikipedia and other things, mm-hmm. is not a bad thing. It's actually an enabling thing that will enable us to do more in the classroom. Whereas in the past, what one was doing was saying, here is the information. Now you assume that everybody can get access to the information. What are we going to do with it?
Yeah. And it underlines that point about history being so empowering. And this has always been true, particularly in terms of challenging myths or not allowing individuals to distort reality for their own particular purposes. And this gives an added layer of empowerment and enablement so that people can have access to this material themselves and they can distill it and they can analyse it. That is hugely empowering, and it's great that we can frame this discussion in such a positive context. But there are always going to be the worries that there will be a gulf between that positivity on the one hand and those great opportunities, and whether or not it's a priority at the level of policy and of those who are deciding.
What about the debates that occurred in the media about revisionism in Irish history and so on? To what extent was that reflected or taken up, say, at second level in the teaching of history?
Well, again, it strikes me, talking to students who were contemporaries of mine or came a bit before, that the individual approach of the teacher was hugely revealing in that regard, mm-hmm. and perhaps their political preferences would have influenced that. Right. There's no doubt that historians, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s, like everybody else, were affected by what was going on, and that may have affected the way in which they were teaching history. But at the same time, I think the notion of a conspiracy has been hugely exaggerated. You know, the idea that there was this collective response and collective decision to deliberately distort the past or underplay the role of violence or whatever else it is, this happens in all societies. It goes through different phases, depending on what is going on and depending what information is available. You know, we're coming into an interesting era now around commemoration and the decade of centenaries. All of these questions will be raised again.
I'm thinking of the sense of data, which one might say, you know, his sympathies are very nationalist, saying of a history teacher or not, as the case may be. To what extent did that kind of thing occur?
I suppose it's only human that a word occur, but again, I'll go back to teachers now are working so far, but with changes coming, I think within a very good curriculum at both junior and senior level. So that if you want to talk about a narrative of history, say from a nationalist point of view, that you're also being asked, well, what was it like to be not only a settler in Ireland, say, during the plantations, but also, you know, what it was like to be the person whose land was confiscated. So... you know, both sides, different visions are now being pursued.
Just the broad context here, Ciarán, is that education doesn't rank as a high cabinet post either in the UK or here. That's very much the bottom line, isn't it, with regard to education in general, or indeed any history, any subject within that.
Well, it certainly is my experience, but at the same time, it seems to me that the lack of intervention that we've had has been by and large, a good one. My experience of working on the history curriculum with the NCCA, with teachers and with other educationalists, was an immensely rewarding one, because we were absolutely free to express our opinions without fear of the kind of thing that this book reveals Margaret Thatcher was up to. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if we want to look at the way in which the debate has moved on as mm-hmm. to the relationship of history to its society and history teaching to its society, mm-hmm. to move from the declaration that I quoted from in 1934 to the opening paragraphs of the new curriculum, the new history syllabus, which emphasises parity of esteem, all groups, which emphasises the importance of encouraging historical understanding from all perspectives and the development of a sense of common citizenship.
You get the impression that Thatcher and co. were more concerned with what was happening at the level of theory of education than the world history itself.
You know, but if you look at what Thatcher became very hostile to, particularly after she became Prime Minister, having served as Minister for Education, so critical of theories of education, mm-hmm. of teacher training colleges, of the inspectorate, and of the idea that we had lost Victorian values, mm-hmm. you know, that they weren't instilling that sense in people of pride about the past, but also the focus on the basics. And that's where it becomes an ideological battleground. And in a sense, Margaret Thatcher was backtracking, because she had been associated with the great push towards comprehensive schools. But now the new focus was on, oh, hang on, we have to reclaim the grammar schools. This equality of opportunity, regardless of ability, isn't working. And she had obviously very strong views on that. Not all the people working with her in education agreed with that perspective, but they often made the mistake of attacking the teachers.
You wanted to add something about commemoration.
Yes, earlier I did say that, I mean, it's a wonderful time, but it's also a worrying time for the future of history. Because, as Dermot said, in this extraordinary time of commemorations where, you know, over the next decade we will be, you know, celebrating the journey basically to independence, that with the proposed changes to the junior cert curriculum in the framework document, I mean, history is not only being marginalised, it's potentially going to be dropped as a subject in the schools. And this, of course, is very worrying. And it's quite galling sometimes to kind of listen to the empty rhetoric, because that's what it is, of politicians right up to the Taoiseach himself, who is coming out with great speeches about championing our the great legacy of the past, etc. And we will be hearing more of this over the next 10 years. And by the time we get to 2022, half of the audience he will be addressing will be young people who will not have any knowledge about the journey to independence, will not have any knowledge about the key personalities involved, and will simply not know what it is we have achieved. And if I may finish, the mantra of the History Teachers Association at the moment is, at this particular time, we need more history, not less.
We've been discussing the right kind of history, teaching the past in 20th century England, by David Cannadine, Jenny Keating and Nicola Sheldon. My thanks to Deirdre Mock-Mahuna, Kieran Brady and Dermot Ferriter. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and also on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.